Hi, I'm Johanna Weaver, and you're listening to Tech Mirror, a podcast that talks about how humans shape technology and how technology is shaping our society. My guest today is Frances Haugen, who is a name that will be familiar to most. Frances came to global attention in 2021 through her whistleblowing efforts, raising concerns about the harms being caused by the business practices of her employer at the time, Facebook. Frances now works as an advocate for accountability and transparency in social media and is here in Australia in the studio, which is a real treat for us today. Frances, welcome to Tech Mirror.
Thank you for inviting me. Happy to be here.
Looking back over the last 2.5 years, I mean, it's been a huge 2.5 years for you. What is the thing that perhaps you're most proud of or that you're most surprised by? And they might be the same thing or they might be different things over the course of having came out and, and made the decision to do the whistleblowing on with Facebook.
You know, I got to meet Sharon Watkins and Cynthia Dixon, who are the WorldCom and the Enron whistleblowers from way back in the day. And I got whistleblower protections because of the efforts of those women to advocate for them after their respective scandals. One of the things that I never expected was the European Union passed their first whistleblower protections soon after I visited the European Union. And they specifically credited the magnitude of the information and significance of the information that I brought forward as why they ended up finally getting whistleblower protections over the line. Because they said, we see now that we are entering a new era where we have moved from a tangible economy where we can inspect the products of our economy to an intangible economy. And in an intangible economy without whistleblowers, we never even find out what questions to ask. In terms of things that were most unexpected, I remember when I first came forward, people said to me, like, what can you realistically expect out of the United States? You know, we have very low expectations. You know, it's the cynicism of experience of the last 20 years. All right, we have a vintage constitution, as I like to say. And I said, you know, in a lot of situations historically like this, you know, where it seems like Congress can't act, yet there's an issue of massive societal significance, we've seen the state's attorney generals together, coming together and acting. And the thing that I am most grateful for and surprised that it actually came to be was we now live in a world where 44 states have sued Meta, alleging that they lied about the safety of their products and that the products weren't harmful to children. And for context, the tobacco lawsuit, when it culminated, when it was at the end, they only had 46 states. So we are on par with some of the largest actions that have been taken collectively in the United States history.
And I think that filing probably hasn't had anywhere near as much attention in Australia as it has in the US, and the importance of focusing on the breadth of ways that we can regulate these technologies and have impact. And this is something you've spoken about a lot recently in terms of utilizing the full community that we have in order to be able to bring about the change that we need with social media companies. So could you speak a little about what you mean when you talk about the community?
So for any other industry, we don't expect, you know, the government to wave a magic wand and like make us safe. We expect a network of actors. Those could be insurance companies. Those could be academics. Those could be litigators. Those could be concerned citizens. It could be investors. All these different stakeholder groups have the ability to influence, say, cars or mining or gas and other hydrocarbons. Like major industries, we expect that constellation of actors to all have different interests, different skills, different strengths, and be able to pull those industries towards the public good. When it comes to social media, because we were never allowed to look behind the curtain, we didn't get to build our own independent ecosystem of accountability. And one of the things that I think is a growing trend in the United States is we're seeing people not even waiting for those, we'll call them institutional actors, to get moving. We see a lot more of even parents groups coming in and saying, if we can't, you know, if let's say it takes 2 years for the settlement to come through, it might take 3 years. If you have a 12-year-old, 3 years is a long time. It's a quarter of that child's life. When we talk to teenagers, they say things like, "We don't understand why things take so long." Mm. Right? People are literally dying in around the world from this. Parents are going in and saying, "Hey, we as a community, our school, you know, our neighborhood, our locality, our city is going to wait for 8. So we're going to wait for 14 for giving phones." Mm. It's a great example of how we have been conditioned by big tech companies that we have no options, that we are powerless, we are small, they are big, they are mighty. Working in concert, it stops being a fight between a parent and a kid about, is it time for this kid to have a phone? You can actually build the space for kids to have a childhood by saying together in a school, "Hey, all of us together, kids, parents, we're choosing to wait for 8. Mm. And that makes everyone stronger together.
And I think, so this is a concept that I think is so important, that we have the power to shape the technology, that humans shape technology and technology shapes us. And one of the observations that you made is how amazing it is in Australia that we ban phones from schools. And, you know, this is something that I think people wouldn't necessarily focus on as an important tool that we have at our fingertips.
Just for context, in the United States, if your household is in, say, the 95th percentile or higher for income, you probably go to school where they banned phones.
Yeah.
And so it's this interesting question of, like, I've heard people say things like, "Well, you know, should we really ban phones in schools? Like, kids are going to have to learn to live with these. Like, you know, don't they need critical thinking skills to, like, interact with their phone?" Mm-hmm. And I'm like, you know, I don't want to live in a world where, you know, if you're in the 95th percentile or more, like, if you go to fancy boarding schools in the United States now, the kids have kosher phones. Like, they'll literally give all the kids the same phone just to remove those incentives. Mm. I don't want to live in a world where if you're above some income cutoff, you get to have a non-digital childhood. And if you're beneath that one, you get critical thinking skills.
And I think that probably also fits into some of the concepts moving away from it as a hardware tool, but also into the concepts like filter bubbles and the ways that people experience the internet differently, and particularly social media differently, and say, "Well, look, my social, I'm not getting, I'm not seeing that that portrayal that everyone's talking on, saying that it's dangerous." Mm-hmm. Can you maybe touch on that and the different experiences that people have online and why it's important that we bring more attention to that?
You know, I think one of the things that has made it really hard for many people to connect with some of the things that were in the disclosures, right? So there's 22,000 pages in the Harvard archive now. There's even more from other whistleblowers. You can go through, you can see, or look at the Attorney General's filings. Mm. You can read the excerpts where they have the communications between Facebook employees. It's so hard to reconcile these horrific things you're reading on paper, or at least digital paper, and your own personal experience. You're like, when I sign on to Facebook, when I sign on to Instagram, you know, it's so pleasant. You know, it's pictures of cats, maybe occasionally an otter. You know, when the algorithm gets a little confused. The reality is, most people who are setting tech policy, most people who are upper middle class, they're more socially connected. They have a peer group. The other people they're connected to on social media have a little bit more stability. They have maybe more education. Mm-hmm. They know how to have conflict in maybe more constructive or polite ways. Also, they just participate more. When your friends and family are participating more on social media, you see less content from algorithms. You see less things where a computer decided they're going to gum up your feed with it. And so people need to understand that, like, every single person has a different experience on social media. And it is likely, if you're listening to this podcast, when you open your screen, it is much more pleasant and clean than what the median Australian is seeing. Mm.
And I think many of us who have that cleaner version are still deeply concerned. And so the message here is to challenge yourself to think about the other versions that are being seen out there.
And I think the secondary thing there is it's this question of, like, who gets which version? Right. Mm. So, for example, the core part of my complaints originally was that when we focus on content moderation, we have to pick and choose which languages we support. Mm. Right. That the way these systems work is they have to rewrite the safety systems over and over again, language by language. They have to choose where they invest and refine. Mm. And you end up leaving behind the vast majority of languages. You know, there's 4,000 or 5,000 languages in the world. They do an adequate job on maybe 20. They allegedly support maybe 100. When they say support a language, they have at least one safety system in that language. you know, do you want to live in a country where the people who don't speak English are the ones that get the most dangerous version of a product? Mm. Do you want the people who are the most socially isolated, so they spend the most time online, do you want them getting the most concentrated harm? Because you end up getting these feedback loops.
And you've been quite critical of content moderation as a way to address this. And you've advocated quite strongly for transparency measures as an alternative.
Or process-based things.
Yeah, so looking at it as a system as well. Paint us a picture for what it would look like if we did have transparency in these systems and what that would then unlock.
I've been in Australia now for maybe 10 days. One of the new Australianisms I learned is this phrase, open slather, as in social media is a bit of an open slather. If I'm using it wrong,
pardon me.
I'm not Australian. But literally my husband like read it out loud to me because he got sent it as a text from like one of the people we're coordinating with. And he's like, what does that mean? And we're like sitting there Googling it. Find out it's just an Australian and Kiwi thing.
I had no idea that open slather was a specific to Australian term. And I'm pretty good at that because I've worked internationally. Like the jobs I've tried to keep colloquialism out of my tone. There you go.
And that's a human thing. Like I always fess up on, you know, when I worked at Facebook, before I worked at Facebook, I never cared about linguistic diversity.
Yeah.
Right. And I worked on localization at one point on Google Books. Right. I never thought about how do our algorithms interact in different languages. Mm. Right. Because it becomes invisible to us. Like we forget that speech is not universal. But, these systems are incredibly brittle. Right. Let's split into kind of three pillars of why content moderation just doesn't work that well. Like people want to say, why can't we just get rid of the terrorism? Why can't we get rid of the hate speech? Mm. Well, the first thing is, what is terrorism? Like, what is terrorism content? What is hate speech? Like, there's a huge continuum there. Next question is, can a computer understand those shades of gray? So one of the things that came out of the Facebook files was, you know, in the case of Arabic, they were auditing Arabic systems and they said, you know, if you look at our terrorism classifier, because computers have so much trouble understanding whether or not someone is committing the violation or is talking about the violation, because the computers are not intelligent, they don't actually understand the significance. They're looking at a bunch of words, they're looking at context, they don't understand significance, they don't understand like implication, that kind of thing. 75% of the counterterrorism content was getting labeled as terrorism content and taken down. And we can laugh at that and say, oh, well, that's a one-off thing. Well, I'll give you another example. I have traveled all around the world talking to civil society groups. It's like one of my great privileges is like being able to go there and say like, I see you, you're doing amazing work, whatever I can do to support you. And one of the things that's really shocked me is it doesn't matter what country I go to. When I talk to people who are advocating against violence against women online, so these are like pro-women groups, across the board, it could be in Germany, it could be in Brazil, it could be in the Netherlands, it could be in France, it doesn't matter where I go. They say my entire team has lost their Facebook accounts because the computer can't tell the difference between committing violence against women and talking about violence against women. So that's the first issue. Computers are not smart. Understanding language is really complicated. It's much easier to generate language than derive meaning from language. Second issue is that brittleness. You know, you throw in dialects, it goes completely off the rails. When I was at Facebook, I never saw a system that tuned beyond American English and British English. So it was like you're either in American English or you're international English. And we saw the consequences of this in the referendum. Mm. When I was here six months ago, it just happened to be the referendum was going on. You know, we had planned this trip months in advance. I didn't even know there was a referendum coming up because I'm an ignorant American. And I show up and it turns out the indigenous populations had been asking for 6 months, can you please have parity? Like, let's not even get into the fuzzy areas of hate speech. Let's just talk about racial slurs, like the most toxic, most offensive racial slurs. Could we just have parity with the United States? Like, if you use a horrible racial slur in the United States in a comment, that comment is not going to be posted. If you persist in posting posts with racial slurs, you will be asked to have a timeout. If you persist still, you will get blocked, right? Taken down. Can we just have parity? And Facebook never responded until a couple of days before the election. right? I think I did it, I started using that as an example in interviews, and like 2 days later, they made a public statement, right? That's the thing about these companies. They understand that because we don't have laws that entitle us to a right to know, entitle us to be able to ask real questions, get real answers, they can just spin things as long as they want to. It's marketing over substance, and we're the ones who pay the cost.
And that's why you advocate so strongly for transparency. So can you explain what you mean by that?
So one of the things I always frame to people is, you know, if I were to stop a random person on the street and ask them, how do we make social media safe? They would almost certainly say, well, we should really take down that bad thing. And part of the reason why the palette that we have in our minds of how to solve these problems starts and ends with take down the bad thing is because the only way you learn how to build these systems or make them safer is you work inside the companies. You can't get a graduate degree. You can't get an undergraduate degree in how to build these systems. Like I always like to say, you know, we have architecture schools that have existed for 200 years because we understand that the choices we make in designing a space change how we interact with each other in that space. We have at best like singular classes in certain universities in the world, not even every university in the world, on digital spaces. They know that if they tell us this is your these are your options, you can either have safety but no free speech, or free speech or no safety, that's it. Then nothing happens. No one marches in the street for more censorship. But if they had come in there and said, hey, we have this huge continuum of possible ways we could deal with any given problem. You know, in cybersecurity, we talk about, quote, the kill chain. You know, it's a phrase that comes out of the military, right? The defense sector. And, you know, we say like, you know, that every single harm on social media started from an initiator, like someone initiated it. They had motivations. They had opportunity. They created the action in motion that was then distributed. It was amplified. Different things happened. There were lots of different places along the way. We could have influenced those. Someone eventually received that content. We could have softened the blow. We could have said, hey, you're about to see hate speech. You know, I'm going to blur this for you. You can click on it. You can see it if you want. Even that moment of preparation helps someone. We could take care of the person after it happens. There's a whole continuum there of actions. But in a world where you're told you have options, and some of those options actually sound kind of appealing, right? Like, you know, I think we can all agree there's ambiguity on individual acts of hate speech. You know, there's a lot of ways you can interpret any given statement. But if you found out someone had been leaving 20 cruel comments every day, only on women's posts, you might say, that's interesting, right? You know, there's these little things where we come in, and if people realized there were appealing options, they would demand more. And the companies don't want you asking those questions. A lot of my examples around kids, I just can't tell in Australia because you guys banned phones in schools.
Yeah.
Right. So in the United States, you know, Facebook did research. This came out of the AG filings, the Attorney General filings. They did research and kids said, hey, when I get notifications during the school day, it distracts me. It makes me anxious. It makes me less productive. Duh.
Surprise.
Yeah. Or like, hey, when you send me notifications late at night, it makes it hard to sleep. Surprise. And they ran experiments. We're like, oh, like that makes sense. Like maybe we shouldn't do that. Turns out when you don't send children notifications during the day, they're less anxious and more productive. Who knew? Turns out they go to sleep earlier if you don't send them late at night. 1% less growth, right? 1% less consumption. And yet because there are no checks and balances, right? In a system that is opaque, the only person who gets to weigh the trade-off is, it is a nation full of less anxious children worth 1% less growth? In a world where that decision is only made internally, or maybe only made by one person, you can end up in a world like the one we live in now, which is they chose to continue sending notifications during the school day.
You're listening to Tech Mirror, a podcast from the Australian National University's Tech Policy Design Centre. If you like what you're hearing, we would love it if you could give us a 5-star rating, or even better, leave us a short review on your podcast platform of choice. Now, enough interruptions from me. Let's dive back into this episode. And so what countries are doing this well? What countries are helping to shift the incentive structure? And I mean, the gold standard that's always held up is the Digital Services Act in the EU, online harms in the UK.
Those are our two that exist.
Yes, yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah, gold standard versus actually exist. I guess that is an important distinction. What would you create if you could create a transparency system mechanism that was gold standard? And what do you think is the minimum that we can accept?
You know, when people say like the DSA is the gold standard, beyond the fact that it's the first mover, it exists. I think a second way to think about it is that it also represents a shift in kind of the philosophy of how you intervene. So Australia really put, you know, the flag on the map back in the 2010s when they said, hey, there's just stuff that's illegal, right? You know, they took it one step further than, say, Germany did, where Germany had had laws saying you can't have pro-Nazi content, you can't go after immigrants. Like there were small buckets. They said, like, this is just prohibited. But there was a larger conversation around where do the laws apply online? And can give you a sense of like what kind of world we live in. That was revolutionary.
Yeah. And here you're talking about the e-safety commission.
Commissioner, that kind of thing. You know, like no one acted in Australia acted.
We should be proud of that, Australia.
You should be proud of that. It's a big deal.
Yeah.
But the framing of how to think about how to solve these problems has really shifted. So instead of thinking of it as like, we are going to police the content, you know, every time you have violating content, it's a $45,000 fine, you know, whatever it is. If instead you say, hey, if we have trouble even identifying the content, like if the computers can't figure out what's going on, we can't write laws like that. So we have to do something else. And the thing that really changed the game about the Digital Services Act is it came in and said, if we can't regulate this at the level of individual pieces of content, right, without, you know, having the counterterrorism problem happen again, the women's advocates problem again, you know, let's instead focus on process. So we're going to say, you know, we got to where we are today because of information asymmetry. Like, we don't know what's going on in your systems. You're the expert. Let's just start there and acknowledge that. You have a positive obligation to tell us what harms you know about. And if you don't tell us about harms you know about, and, you know, say a whistleblower comes forward, you're going to be in trouble. You know how to solve your problems better than we do. We're not going to tell you you have to do X, Y, Z because we know you have a much, much deeper tool chest of how to solve these problems and you understand the trade-offs on them. So you need to give us a plan on how you're going to prevent and mitigate each of those harms. And because, unfortunately, you've established a track record that we can't trust you, right? You have to give us enough data that we know that you're actually making progress. Like you can't grade your homework anymore because we've seen how that what that went. And what's really interesting about this kind of approach is it's dynamic, right? As we all collectively, that's the platforms, that's us together, learn more about how these systems work, we're going to identify different kinds of harms. As some platforms innovate and figure out different ways to solve problems, we're going to be able to cross-pollinate solutions across it. Once we have access to data, it's not just about the government grading that homework. It's about especially if you write your laws so that data has to be public. Mm-hmm. And that's really important. Yeah. I think the European Union did a better job than the UK at this. You can actually unleash an ecosystem of educators who interpret these issues for their communities, right? Like my dream is one day to not show up in this podcast studio as much as I like coming to Australia. It's to sit at home and make YouTube videos and explain this for everyone, right? Because that gives a much higher level of democratic access than, you know, my coming and talking to a few regulators. And I care really, really intensely about like little d democracy, like the idea that if we don't have at least a million people worldwide who have a level of comprehension that's similar to mine, I don't think we actually get to have democratic conversations about trade-offs.
Yeah. And that really is what's motivating my team and I to build out the education program, which will be Australia's first tech policy education curriculum. I'd like to touch a little bit more on this point about small d democracy, particularly in the year that we're moving into is the year where the most people ever in history around the world will be going into elections. What do you... are you concerned about that in terms of the impact of social media on the electoral processes?
We have one of those challenges where, you know, they say the best time to plant a tree is 30 years ago.
Yeah.
And the second best time is today. We are entering into a year that I think is extremely dangerous because we are going in with substantially less defenses than we had 4 years ago, which is can be shocking to people. Usually we move in the direction of more defenses, not less defenses.
Can you explain a bit?
So a number of things happened in that intervening time. So kind of the trigger motion for the trigger action that led to me leaving Facebook was Facebook had spent 4 years, beginning in the aftermath of the 2016 elections in the United States, building out the top election safety team in the world. So you had a team of maybe 300 people that spread across a huge number of disciplines that were focused on things like preventing ethnic violence because, you know, the year I joined, which is 2019, the UN came out with a report, 250 pages long, that in great detail explained how Facebook's negligence led to the death of 25,000 people in Myanmar, right? We had seen that there was real danger to social media. And for a long time, I think Facebook acted in good faith and tried to ask real questions about how to make the platform safer. In the immediate wake of the election, so we're talking less than 30 days after the election, they brought our whole team together virtually, because this is during COVID, and they said, we are dissolving civic integrity. Or to correctly quote them, you are so important, we are integrating you into the rest of the company. Right? You can go cross-pollinate.
Did they say this is a great opportunity? That's what I find when people say it's a great opportunity. That's my...
That's the red flag.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I'm almost certain they said this is a great opportunity. And that was the moment for me when I realized that like Facebook would not be able to solve its own problems in isolation. And the thing that's so sad about what happened next was over the next 6 months, a huge number of my coworkers all quit.
Yeah.
Right. They saw this action as what it was.
Yeah.
And I remember when I told my manager I was leaving, he asked me not to tell anyone for a week, because someone else was going to announce that they were leaving, and he was worried about the trend. And I remember my last couple of days I was there, I had to have a meeting with this new person who just joined the team. And I felt so bad for him because literally everyone in our 6 or 7 person pod had left. Mm. Like I was like, either there were two of us that were kind of left and going out the door. And he's like, I don't know what to do. Like when I start interviewing for this team, like 2 months ago, you had a team and there was no team. So when that happened, I need people to understand the significance of that. There were very few places in the industry that had critical mass for knowledge generation. So when we think about a university has buildings, a university has students, but it has enough people in one place. Like we don't call 4 professors in a small building in the countryside a university. We expect a certain number of people co-located working on problems together before we call it a university, because we need that synergy. We need a community that can reproduce itself. In the entirety of Silicon Valley, there were, you know, maybe 10 companies that were big enough on their trust and safety teams to really do knowledge generation. And Facebook had the best in the world. And they let that go away. The second thing that happened was Elon Musk came in. And he fired half the employees at Twitter immediately. Another 25% quit. He just gutted the fields of who was working on trust and safety there. And that was one of the other few places that had community. Mm-hmm. And the way Meta responded was, you know, Meta didn't disrupt all of their trust and safety teams when they dissolved civic integrity. They just did that part. But in the wake of Elon's actions, you know, Mark Zuckerberg was quoted as saying, Elon showed you could rip the Band-Aid off, you know, that there would be no consequences when you get the short-term gain of not spending money on trust and safety. Because in every single time he did layoffs, no one asked how much less safe are we. The stock price just went up.
Mm. And how do you balance that tension, right? Between, you know, to me, a human's life and a stock price are never going to be something that you balance. But if you're the CEO of a company, you do have an obligation to your shareholders. I'm not defending that, but I think it's a reality of the world that we live in. How can we incentivize or address the profit motivation whilst not being idealistic about it, like actually like tackling it?
Well, I think there's a really, really simple way, which is right now the people who fuel those profits, which are advertisers, don't actually get to consent, right? So they get told various stories about how the company operates. Mm. If you look at the core of the Attorney General's lawsuit in the United States, it's not that the company made products that hurt children. right? Under Section 230, that's probably legal in the United States just because of the way our laws are.
Wouldn't be legal in Australia, just to be clear.
Good thing they're an American company.
Yeah.
No, but what is illegal is lying about your products and saying they're safe when you know they're harmful. That's fraud. And right now, advertisers don't actually know what product they're buying. Because in reality, that's what these things are. When you see a free product, an advertising supported product, you are the product. And right now, you know, I always take a step back and I say, you know, we've accumulated 300 or 400 years of knowledge about corporate governance, right? All the way back to when the Dutch started corporations, we almost immediately were like, oops, we need some rules, right? Like we need to have rituals of how we hold these powerful things in check.
Yeah.
And in the case of social media, because it's intangible, because each of us sees a different thing, almost all of that knowledge is not applicable, or we haven't applied it yet. And so advertisers in any other industry, like let's say you're talking about mining, like if you had child miners, you know, the people who use the products of those mines, they boycott it. You know, they put pressure on those companies to change. In a world where we are not entitled to any information about these platforms, advertisers can't step in and say, I'm not willing to fund this anymore. Mm-hmm. Investors can't step in and say, yes, you are more profitable now, but I'm not willing to accept the cost of that profit. Right now, there are lots and lots of content moderation systems mm-hmm. that are running these companies. They describe them one way. They operate another way. They tell advertisers, we stop hate speech. But they, you know, there's a lot of it going on. Or they say, like, you know, we're not banning you. We're not controlling what you get to see or don't see. But that's not really true. We don't have any idea how these systems work. When they say things like we're gonna block the news, what does that mean? What is the news? Is it a list of specific websites that are banned now? Is it topics? Like when I worked at Facebook, we definitely had a list of what we considered political topics. You know, they got treated in different ways. Imagine a law where we said, hey, you know, we know you're going to fight back against this bill by saying it's a censorship bill. Okay, you have to disclose all your censorship systems. You have to show us how they give us enough data that we can assess how is this working? Like, what's the bias? Does it work in Australia? You have to tell us what languages it supports and give us performance data on those. But it's not enough to show what you're taking down or what you're demoting. You have to show us what you're promoting to. So any post that is seen more than 10,000 times, be it in a closed group or open group, you need to show us that. We need a fire hose of those posts. And we need to understand where you started from. So every month or every week, you need to show us a random 10,000 posts that are picked, weighted by how often they're seen. So if you get seen a million times, you're a million times more likely than a post that was seen once. Because that gives us a portrait of, do you had this material to work with? This is what you sent viral. And it means also we can now spot information operations, influence operations. And we should care far, far more about the national security implications of coordinated efforts to spread information than we should care about your uncle having conspiracy theories that he shares. Because that foreign interference is much, much more dangerous than someone having maybe a misguided thought.
You know, what you're describing there of the response when you try and address this, and the response from companies, but also from society saying, no, don't censor us, is exactly the experience that we've had with Australia's mis and disinformation bill. Where do you think...
I don't think that bill isn't at all executable. Like, it is a deeply flawed bill.
Do you want to talk about why you think it's deeply flawed?
So it's one of these questions on like, for disinformation, for example, state of art disinformation today are true facts that are polarizing and divisive. You know, there's lots of ways to swing an election by just amplifying true facts. So like I talked about before about the idea of like coordinated efforts, like running an influence operation really matters. If you have an election that is dependent on a few percentage points of votes, you know, you can bombard the part of the electorate that's the least likely to vote with stuff that keeps them home. And those are going to be true facts. Do you take those true facts down, right? Like in a world where companies are responsible for dis and misinformation, or how do you adjudicate that something is not true? You just can't do it at scale. You know, bills that focus on content are very, very hard, if impossible, to execute fully. And I think the secondary thing is, I think it's super divisive to give centralized authority to assess that true or falseness, right? Because even people who agree will feel uncomfortable about the idea that the what you have been allowed to know has been manicured.
So I agree with what you've just said there. I think the good thing about that bill was the call for transparency and the provision of information. And I hope that
keep that. That's great.
Yeah. And you know, the government has said that it's looking at it. It was an exposure draft, so we'll all be watching very closely.
Rename it too, because if you call it the misinformation bill, it'll never pass.
Yeah. And I really like what you're saying about the censorship transparency. Yeah. It's a very smart twist on that.
And think about it. You can come back and say, like, we heard you. Like, we've been listening to the last 6 months. Like, we get it. We messed up. Mm. You're afraid of being censored. You deserve to know when you're censored. You should have a right to know. Mm. And that's what we're going to focus on instead.
Mm. What else do you think Australia should be focusing on? I'm really interested if there are particular opportunities in a positive way that you think Australia should be leaning into to shape the way that we're regulating technology.
You know, the summer before I came forward, Instagram launched a whole bunch of child safety features in 1 week. Mm-hmm. They were like, we're going to do this for privacy. Random adults will no longer contact your child. This thing, you know, like stuff that should be like, duh, why didn't you do this years ago? They launched it all in the same week, and they're like, we really care about kids. And in reality, this thing called the age-appropriate design code went into force in the UK. Mm. So the UK has 65 million people. Canada plus Australia have 65 million people. When a single country of 65 million people raised the floor, they raised the floor everywhere in the world. Mm. Like, we take for granted the idea that you need to be the size of the United States or the size of the European Union to get things done. If you can get together 200 million people, you know, that's less than 10% of the users of Facebook. But if you get together countries that make up 200 million people, you get to set the rules where the floor is for the internet. Mm. And I think there's a huge, huge value in, you know, if we look at what's going to take to implement the DSA, you know, it's not enough to pass laws that say, you're going to find out what the harms are of social media.
Yeah.
You need people who have enough context so they can interpret those reports and say, that is inadequate. And there is a huge, huge value in being able to share that expense across more countries. Mm. So let's say Canada's bill is like they only have two classes of prohibited content. You know, they really heard, so they did a really interesting process that I think would be cool to repeat in Australia, which is they held three rounds of citizen assemblies. Mm. So they brought together, you know, each time about 100 people, selected representatively across the diversity of this Canada. They brought them to a single place for a whole week, which sounds crazy, but like they got something like a 7% response rate. Mm-hmm. So they sent out postcards to people and they're like, do you want to sit in a hotel and learn about social media and like argue with your neighbors about how we should govern the internet? And 7% of people said yes,
yeah.
Which is crazy when you think about what people do to get out of jury duty.
Yeah.
Right. and imagine spending your precious vacation time. That's how you're going to spend it. But people came out of it saying it was a very positive experience, that we feel a lot of frustration, like there's nothing that can be done on the internet. Mm. And yet when they did this, so they did it three times, two times with adults, one time with 18-year-olds, because they wanted to get the voice of youth. And what they came up with was this bill. You know, it's the most democratically produced online safety bill that has been made anywhere in the world as a result. And so it's one of these things where it shows you, like, when you have a democratic process, you can get something that's actually quite sensible. Mm. But when you have more countries say, okay, so this is going to be the model we're going to share, Australia plus Canada actually is a really good critical mass. But then in the case of, say, your neighbors across Southeast Asia, some of those places are hotspots for violence, right? They are much, much, much more dependent on social media as their information ecosystem than Australia is. Mm-hmm. Sometimes because Facebook went into those countries and said, if you use our products, your data's free. If you use anything else, you're going to pay for it yourself, right? So it's not an accident that they're dependent. But secondly, you know, I had a government official the last time I was in Australia say to me very earnestly that they were so grateful I had visited because, you know, it's so frustrating. They have so little access to experts. And I remember being just kind of floored because, like, so much of my work is done internationally. And I just like stared at them for a moment. And then I like took a breath and I was like, you are aware you speak English, right? Like, what do you think people in Malaysia think, right? Or Indonesia? And so there's a real opportunity where if Australia can come up with a sensible model and you say, hey, we are going to share resources, right? We're going to have a single internet observatory across our system because we can democratically govern it or have oversight maybe in ways that are going to be a little bit more protective than, say, a more authoritarian country would. You know, we can use our institutional expertise to make sure it's done in a safer way. But at the same time, give people voices and accountability for these platforms that would never happen otherwise. And the reason why this is so important is if those places get destabilized, the consequences will show up on Australia's shore. You know, you are not isolated from the consequences of the neglect and abuse of these platforms.
Now, we've got through almost an entire conversation without saying artificial intelligence, but I did promise someone from a roundtable that we were on just before that I would ask you about regulation of artificial intelligence. I don't even know how to encapsulate this in a short question. What are your must-haves in the next year around the regulation of artificial intelligence to avoid perhaps some of these harms, particularly around electoral issues?
We cannot put the horse back in the barn. Like Facebook Meta open sourced their model. They broke the convention on like, should you basically do nuclear proliferation? I did not sign the pause, which was like a big effort where they said like, things are moving too fast. Yeah. We need to just slow on down. So I'm a Cold War studies minor. And when people do nuclear analogies, I usually like, you know, flinch a little bit because like they were, you know, in the language of the pause, they were like, you know, we learned that like nuclear weapons were too dangerous. And so we did a test ban treaty. And the thing that's so interesting about that analogy is, you know, the first test ban treaty banned testing in the air, in the water, on the land, but it didn't ban it underground. And you might say, well, if these are so dangerous and they can end civilization, like why didn't we ban it everywhere? And it's because we didn't have the technology to differentiate between an earthquake and an atomic bomb.
Yeah.
It took inventing something called verification. It took inventing something called a Fourier fast transform. Speaking of technology shapes us and we shape technology. Mm-hmm. Someone invented this algorithm, which you use every day in a variety of technologies you use. And it, for the first time, could separate the frequencies of the rumble and say, this is an earthquake, this is an atomic bomb. When it comes to a lot of the doomsaying about AI, if that is going to happen, it's going to happen because we don't know if the bad code is running in a data center somewhere, right? And so what do we do then? So if the horse is out of the barn, if we cannot verify whatever, you know, we can put in these rules, we can't verify that our adversaries aren't cheating, what do? We harden the infrastructure. That means we harden energy, telecommunications. We harden social media. Remember, we don't need AIs that are so smart they wake up and decide to kill us. We just need AIs that are good enough at lying to us that we kill each other. And the reality is that our social media systems are not ready at all. And this comes back to, again, this question of like, what is the gold standard for legislation? We need different kinds of defenses to guard against an attack like this. But we will only have the staffing on hand to actually build those new defenses if there are incentives that encourage companies to be responsible. And that means saying like, hey, you are going to have to disclose what you're doing to mediate this risk. And this is one of these things where I don't think we're going to do these things in time. Like, I think we're going to have a very, very messy year.
Yeah.
It's going to be a very messy year. And the only bright side I can see from this is I always like to say, never waste a crisis. You know, a high quality crisis, few and far between. But the question is, you know, what happens when that crisis happens, right? You know, the thing I keep trying to remind people, particularly around kids' issues, is the idea that we are not going to act is off the table. The question is, are we waiting for, quote, the wrong child to die, where we pass emotional, extreme, passionate laws, which are almost always bad, right? Passionate lawmaking is a very bad thing. Right, says the nice, calm Midwesterner. Ugh, yeah. Get the passion out of the laws. Or do we want to pass sensible, moderate, practical laws sooner? Because the reality is one day the quote wrong child will die. Same thing happens with this election. I'm really scared about what do we do when things blow up, how do we respond? Do we have in place sensible, practical things? You know, the Canadian bill has had a lot of work put into it to be something that is, when you talk to a lot of people, they say that's a sensible medium. Or do we put in something really draconian because, quote, the wrong child died? But I think the last thing, I want to go to that dedication. I feel like a huge fraction of all the work I do is just reminding people that hope is possible, right? That the idea that you could not be angry with technology, or that you could not be disgusted with the actions of tech leaders. Like, that is a world you could live in. It can be different. And the thing I often leave people with is, like, when you feel fatalism, that is a sign that someone is trying to steal your power. Because, like, the story of the 20th century is like the story of these impossible things happening, right? Like, if we rolled back in time to 1880, if we counted all the people in the world that thought that India would be free one day, it was like 1,000 crazy Indians in the National Congress. Even they thought they were crazy, right? Or like the Soviet Union fell. Like, no one in 1960 thought that was possible, or apartheid ended, right? And these things don't happen for free. The world changes because we change it. So the way we get a chance to change the world is we were crazy enough to believe that the world could be different. And so the thing I ask of people is, like, even if you don't think it's possible, I encourage you to imagine, because the only way we begin to demand more is we give ourselves the space to accept there could be more. And that's scary because that gives us responsibility. But go out and dream it, because that's how we get to build it one day.
Thank you, Frances. I really appreciate your generosity of time, but also your passion and the courage that you have had over the last, well, longer than 2.5 years, making the decision to do what you did. And I've written it in a card, but I'll say it publicly as well. I think you are inspiring so many people internationally, and that impact is really significant. So thank you for what you're doing, and thank you for spending the time with us on Tech Mirror.
My pleasure.
Tech Mirror is a podcast of the Tech Policy Design Centre at the Australian National University. This episode was recorded on Ngunnawal lands with sound engineering by ANU Studio. Amy Denmead provided invaluable research support. Post-production is by Martin Franklin from East Coast Studio. Thanks for listening. Get in touch and get involved.